From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Megan Mack. Our connection this hour was made 21 years ago, 1999. That summer, networks released their schedules for the upcoming fall television season. Do you remember some of the shows that premiered on primetime TV in 1999? The West Wing, Law & Order SVU, The Sopranos, just to name a few. And do you see any similarities in that list of shows? The president of the NAACP did. Kwaezi Mfume released a statement slamming the four major networks because of the 26 new shows on the schedule, not one featured a person of color in a leading or prominent role. Mfume said, quote, "When the television viewing public sits down to watch the new primetime show scheduled for the fall's lineup, they will see a virtual whitewash in programming. This glaring omission is an outrage and a shameful display by network executives who are either clueless, careless, or both," end quote. As reported last month by the LA Times, this was all happening just before the NAACP's 90th annual convention in New York. Mfume threatened CBS, NBC, ABC, and Fox with a variety of actions, including possible litigation, as well as viewer boycotts of the networks. The networks acknowledged that they could and should do more to diversify their casting and star power. The LA Times reports, quote, "Within months, memorandums of understanding promising improvement were signed by the networks, which appointed diversity executives to oversee the process. The NAACP joined forces with several minority advocacy groups, including the National Hispanic Media Coalition, which issued regular report cards grading the movement," end quote. For the last two decades, networks have gradually added stars of color to the lineup. But here's why the LA Times zeroed in on the 1999 issue. The major networks have all put out recent statements pledging solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement, but their records do not necessarily reflect that kind of commitment. 21 years after Mfume called for change, the networks are facing another possible turning point. The Times chided the networks for what it calls an escalation in pledges to do better without actually doing much better. This time, there will be more scrutiny. Our guests are here to discuss all of that and the state of diversity in television. Joining me for this hour are Calvin Brown Jr. He's a television producer and writer known for his work on shows like Moesha, Married with Children, and My Brother and Me. Most recently, he's the executive producer of The Proud Family, Louder and Prouder. Calvin, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm very proud to be here.
Tina Chapman is here. She's the director of diversity theater at RIT. Tina, welcome to you.
Thank you.
Chris Thompson is a local engineer, writer, comedian, and activist. Chris, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
And later in the hour, we'll hear from Dr. Darnell Hunt. He's the Dean of Social Sciences and a professor of sociology and African American studies at UCLA. He's been studying diversity in television for many years and has reported on some of the statistics that we'll hear about later. But first, I'd like to start by asking all of my guests for their perspectives on how the networks and even streaming services like Netflix have responded to the Black Lives Matter movement. Calvin, I'll start with you. How did you view their tweets and statements?
You know, it's early. It could just be window dressing and happy talk saying that we're going to make a difference. But I honestly think they actually want to make a difference more this time around. I mean, things have changed. 21 years ago when the article came out, I remember that same year, I think that was the year that Fox cleaned house of all of the African-American shows. I think Martin and Living Color, a couple other black shows were all canceled that same year, and then there were no shows to replace it. So I definitely remember that time. And I honestly do think, though, they're trying. At least right now at Disney Television Animation, they've been really positive. We've had a couple of meetings, group meetings, Zoom meetings, to talk about the situation, and the people in charge have been very, very, you know, upfront with us and very forthcoming and say they really want to make a difference. So I guess we'll have to wait and see.
What do you think is different about this time as opposed to 1999? What about society or culture has changed that you think it may be more effective?
I think what's changed more than anything is their cell phones now with cameras. And now all the stuff that you used to just hear about, now it's been seen. And I think especially what happened in Minneapolis when a guy is begging, please get your knee off my throat so I can breathe. Help me. And to have him be ignored and to ultimately die on camera pretty much, I think that was pretty jarring to a lot of people who are like saying, wow, maybe this is real, you know?
Chris, we've had conversations with you on this program previously about that very issue, the existence of cameras on cell phones and how that contributes to societal change, if that's actually happening. How do you view the state of diversity right now in terms of how do you view these networks' responses to the Black Lives Matter movement?
I really think I kind of agree that it's a little bit too early to say, but I think that they said some very nice things. Whether they're doing it as part of the trend, because a lot of people have been saying a lot of nice things, but then not doing anything, we can only tell. I do know that, at least from personal experience, you know, Netflix put out something saying, you know, Black Lives Matter, and then, like, their suggested black voices, some of their suggested black voices television was a couple of things from some black people, but then they also had the help, which is not what we need at all. So I really think that if they really want to show and prove, they need to hire people behind the camera and in front of the camera to really, you know, promote what they claim. If they really want to diversify and really make their programming better, it's going to have to be like, it's going to take a while, but it's going to have to be like a full throttle effort.
So since you zeroed in on Netflix, Chris, I'll read their tweet. It says, quote, "To be silent is to be complicit. Black Lives Matter," end quote. The company added that it had a duty to its African-American customers, employees, creators, and performers to speak up. So they're addressing silence is being complicit. Tina, do you consider that window dressing or a Band-Aid, or do you see it as a real commitment to change?
Well, it's not for me to really judge to say if it's a real commitment for change or not, because change is hard. And a good friend of mine and also diversity consultant, Mary Frances Winters, once wrote a book entitled Only Wet Babies Like Change. And when you think about that, change does take time, and also change can be swift in terms of what exactly can be done right away and what things are systematic that have a longevity of change efforts that are needed. So we need to obviously not be, you know, complicit. We need to no longer be silent. And one of the differences that are going on, that's going on right now, and I've heard, I think Calvin say this too, that we now have cell phones with cameras. And just like the reason why we're having these conversations is because the power of imagery in terms of TV or smartphone or in the movie theater, the same thing is going on when we are doing our own reporting or showing what we're seeing in our front lawns or in our neighborhoods or on our streets and showing it with imagery from the technology that we have available to the individuals who are not behind the camera or filmmakers or studio executives. So we have quite a bit of content that's being shown that requires people to see it and to no longer just push it, you know, under the rug and say, well, that's not really happening here, or we have time to do better. You know, George Floyd did not have time. Other people did not have time. So time is of essence, but we have to continue moving forward with where we are and what we're demanding and what we are asking and what people are capable of doing.
I have a list of some of the moves that the networks have pledged to make, and I want to run those by our guests in a moment. But before we do that, I'd like Calvin to help walk us through what was happening in 1999, and I guess the 90s in general, when some of these concerns were being addressed in a similar but perhaps less intense way. Calvin, some of the shows that you worked on were on the air in 1993, 1994, 1995. Thinking about the start there all the way up through 1999, what kinds of tangible change did you see within the industry that you actually thought was effective?
Well, one thing that I think was effective and I think is still the only way to be effective is having writers in television who are not just writers but are showrunners, executive producers, co-executive producers, supervisor producers, people that can actually do something as far as inside the room. What we really need, though, is more people on the network side who can greenlight you. That is the problem, and that was the problem back then, and to an extent it's still the problem now. I mean, they've been making a lot of progress. Just a few years ago, the whole Roseanne situation when she you know, compared Valerie Jarrett to something from Planet of the Apes. And she was fired literally less than an hour later because she forgot to, you know, she actually forgot that the head of ABC Network at the time was a black woman. And she literally, like, you know what, these days are over. So she fired her on the spot from her own show. And that's what is missing, at least back then and to an extent now. She's actually, the young lady's actually left ABC, is now one of the people running Netflix. So that is great news for people who do what I do, who are creators and television writers. So that's the biggest difference between what was going on in the early 90s compared to now. But we're still a long way away from being in a situation where, you know, you have people in the ivory towers understanding what you're doing and what you're talking about and understanding, say, the black or the brown or any person of color is experienced. Because, you know, the problem is the majority of people that have these jobs, they're white, and I'm not knocking them because they're white, but I'm knocking them because they're afraid to try. They're afraid to do something different. Most of the time, the only time you'll see something happen is like somebody creates a black show and it's a success, then for the next 3 years, you'll have every network trying to do something similar to that until we get back to where we were before.
You've worked on a number of shows. I mentioned some of them in the introduction, Moesha, My Brother and Me, The Proud Family. You also worked on Hanging with Mr. Cooper, The Sinbad Show. How many writers or producers of color did you work with throughout your, and are you working with throughout your career? What percentage would you say were African-American or Latino as compared to white?
I've been blessed. My mentor, Ralph Farquhar, who I'm still working with to this day, I've been working with him for 30 years now, he was one of the very first black showrunners with a voice and a different perspective. And Debbie Allen actually took me from my job on A Different World, the writer's internal staff of A Different World in 1989, 1990, and Debbie took me away from the show and hooked me over to Ralph, and Ralph and I wrote a pilot, and 31 years later, we're still working together. So I've been blessed because I was taught by somebody who's very, very, very pro-black, and when I've done my own shows or if I've, you know, run shows and done stuff, I've really tried my best to make sure we have people of color represented in the room because, you know, when the business first started even, I mean, some of the shows that are, like, considered classics now, the Sanford and Sons, the Jeffersons, a lot of times there was maybe one, two people of color on the writing staff, and a writing staff can be, as you know, small as five, but as large as 20 people, and you only have like a couple people in there. So I've been blessed. I will say at least half of the productions I've worked on, 50% of productions I've worked on, have had either black producers or me being that black producer. So that's just the real.
Tina, I'll ask you the same question for your work in theater. How many writers, producers, directors have you worked with that are people of color throughout your career? What percentage breakdown would you say that looked like?
Wow, that's a good question. The current work that I do right now is in theater and film. And my program at RIT is called Diversity Theater. We spell it with an ER because, like I said, I incorporate film and theater in it. And the journey has not been always welcoming. And again, I'm not in Hollywood. You know, I'm here in Rochester, New York, and I'm in a small, much smaller, you know, industry network here. And our university has a school of film and animation, and that's where I did my work and got my start on the film side. But on the theater side, you know, we have regional theaters here, local community theaters here, and there usually is not a high representation of people of color. And as a person of color myself, you have to get to a point where you are just going to go ahead and dive into that arena, even if you may not see people who look like you. That does not mean that you are unwelcomed, but it does make you wonder if you are going to run into any type of barriers. The other side of that is also the casting. Oftentimes, you wouldn't try out for a role unless it says they're going to do blind casting or something like that, or unless you know the material will have a character that a casting director could see you, you know, playing. I've done a few commercials here locally, and oftentimes when they seek me out for those things, they already know who I am and what I look like. So it's not a matter of, you know, any exclusion types of feelings regarding that. The people that I have worked with, now again, my program is diversity theater. And so the film that we've shot that we're using right now on our campus to bring about more conversations about diversity and inclusion is called Brick by Brick. Now, I wrote the piece. It's about my father's life from 1920s in Ohio and his journey of becoming the first African-American licensed and bonded contractor in Cleveland, Ohio in circa 1956. So I was the writer, but I had a course that I created called Pre-Production Diversity Films. And again, this is on a college level. So these are students who have various backgrounds who are working with me. You know, I'm giving them, you know, open opportunities to look at the script and, you know, kind of look at what are some changes we need to make or what are the pieces we're going to use because it's a feature length script and what are we going to do for a short film. I also partnered with a producer from Los Angeles, a woman who's actually from Israel, and she ended up coming to Rochester, Mickey Levy, and producing the film or working with me as a producer with me on the film. So I tried to open it up from the student perspective and also from other professionals even outside of Rochester so that we would have a more inclusive effort in terms of from the creative side, the pre-production, the production, and even on the post. My editor was someone who was from India. My cinematographer was also from India. And, you know, in terms of the story itself, we tried to make sure that we were not necessarily sticking to any type of stereotypes, but had scenes where we have people who would visibly identify as white or as black or as Latino or Latinx in the story itself. But it's a conscious effort because any work that we do, especially on the creative side, it takes all of your faculties to create these things on the business aspect of it, the financial side and the creative side. And if you're not putting diversity or inclusion also at the top of that list in terms of your priorities, you're going to lose sight of that. And you're going to end up going with either what works easier for you or the people that you know who are just right here because you've been working with them before. And you have to actually cast your net much wider on a conscious basis and be intentional about bringing other people into the creative process for the work that you do. And so I don't know if that answers your question. I don't have statistical numbers for you, but those are the priorities and the things that I think are most important for these types of endeavors.
I think that's really important. And you've addressed the issue of bringing more diversity into productions from multiple angles. So people that are on camera, on stage, your casts versus what's happening behind the scenes and the power and the, I guess, systemic change that can happen in that regard too. And when you consider that, and you look at what the networks are doing in recent weeks and months, I'd like to get all of your responses to that. And Chris, I'll start with you because you never hold back. And I can't wait to hear what you have to say about some of these decisions, which, you know, all of you may have different opinions about. But we'll start with CBS. CBS Television Studios and the NAACP have entered into a multi-year agreement to develop and produce scripted and unscripted programming. In addition to documentary content, CBS has also committed to increasing the proportion of people of color on its series writing staffs and the proportion of script development money devoted to series with creators or producers of color, something both Tina and Calvin have mentioned. And here's, Chris, what I'd like you to respond to. ABC is reviving the nostalgic coming-of-age comedy The Wonder Years, which will now center on a black middle-class family in the 1960s. The series is being developed by Daniels and Fred Savage, who starred in the original version. And one critic said, quote, "We don't need a black version of that show. We already had it. It was called Everybody Hates Chris. It's The Wonder Years in blackface," end quote. Chris, do you agree? Yes, go ahead.
I don't know. Honestly, we don't need a black Wonder Years. But if they actually put it in context, if it's 1960s America that they're doing the Wonder Years and it's an all-black cast, they better address everything that was going on in the 1960s for black people. Like, there better be, like, some busing issues. There better be some real estate problems. There better be the same, like, amount of law enforcement and unfair justice that they were getting in the 60s that we're getting now. Like, it had better be good. Like, this better not be like some feel-good Wonder Years thing. Wonder Years better be ironic because they plan on bringing that back.
Calvin, I don't know if you have any inside information about what's happening with that show. I certainly don't. But what are your thoughts on that choice?
Well, I agree with the statement that Anne Marie Johnson made about, you know, everybody hates Chris, because that was in Chris Rock's mind. That was his version of the Wonder Years from his perspective growing up. Also, I agree that, do we need to have it necessarily? No. But if we're going to do it, I think, like you said, the gentleman just said before me, I think you have to do it right. You have to put everything that went on back then. And then that makes me wonder, how comfortable are non-black viewers are going to feel watching a show, you know, about that, you know? And I know Lee Daniels has done some very, you know, remarkable stuff through the years, you know, starting off with Monsters Ball all the way to Empire. So it might be an interesting twist to see what the Wonder Years will look like from his mind. But personally, instead of redoing the Wonder Years, just do a show similar to the Wonder Years with now, right now in 2020, because what's going on right now, I think, is just mind-blowing. I'm telling you, at New Year's Eve this past year, you know, me and my family were like, you know, waiting to midnight, you know, doing the whole champagne cider thing, wife and the kids, and all of us said, man, 2019 sucked. I'm so glad it's gone. I would kill for 2019 again if I could, to be honest, because this year has been jacked up. So, I mean, if I was going to do a Wonder Years, if it was me, I would do it for what's going on right now, because I constantly tell my kids, you guys are living history. You're living something that's just crazy right now. I mean, I just think that right now what's going on, I think you could do so many really touching and great and important stories, what's going on now. I mean, not just this pandemic, but what's going on, you know, in politics, what's going on, you know, dealing with police brutality. There's so much going on right now that these are the stories we should be talking about.
I have a number of questions from listeners about the kinds of shows and stories you all would like to see. And we'll talk about that in our second half hour. But let's take our only break. When we come back from the break, we'll discuss that. And we'll also hear from Dr. Darnell Hunt from UCLA. So short break, more Connections next. I'm Megan Mack. Thursday on The Next Connections, we discuss a looming crisis of eviction and homelessness. Federal unemployment benefits have run out, and many Americans can't pay their rent or mortgages. What happens next? We explore it. Then in our second hour, a conversation about workers who often feel forgotten, frontline workers in schools and offices during the pandemic. Talk with you Thursday.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Erie Canalway National Heritage Corridor, featuring the Canalway Challenge with 15 to 360 mile options for walking, running, cycling, and paddling along New York's canals and Canalway Trail. More at canalwaychallenge.org.
This is Connections. I'm Megan Mack, sitting in for Evan Dawson today. We're talking about the state of diversity in television. And this conversation was inspired by an article in the LA Times that zeroed in on a 1999 call by the NAACP to increase diversity, both in front of the camera and behind the scenes. My guests for this hour are sharing their perspectives, their experience in the industry. Calvin Brown Jr. is a television producer and writer. He's known for his work on shows like Moesha, Married with Children, The Proud Family, My Brother and Me. And Calvin, your most recent project is The Proud Family, Louder and Prouder, which is a revival of The Proud Family. For our listeners who may not be familiar, let us know what The Proud Family is.
Well, The Proud Family was the first African-American animated series to premiere on the Disney Channel in 2001. We did three seasons. We did 52 episodes, and we did a movie. And that all ended like in 2006. I mean, it was a really great show. It was a family show. It was a really well-written, smart, funny show, and we had like great audience all across the board. So 15 years later, they contacted us and said, hey, how would you guys like to do 20 brand new episodes of Proud Family for Disney Plus, our new streaming service? So we like, yeah. So that's what we're doing right now, and we're scheduled to premiere pandemic, you know, or not. We're planning to premiere sometime in the fall of 2021, so we're hoping that's still the case. But it's a really good show. If you have never seen it before, all of the episodes now are exclusively on Disney Plus, and check it out.
I can attest to that. I appreciate your work so much. I watch that show. I have younger siblings, and we'd spend many hours watching The Proud Family, and my younger sisters are big fans. So glad to see that show back on the air soon. We're also joined this hour by Tina Chapman, the director of diversity theater at RIT, Chris Thompson, a local engineer, writer, comedian, and activist. And now joining us on the line from UCLA is Dr. Darnell Hunt, the dean of social sciences, a professor of sociology and African American studies there. And Dr. Hunt, thank you so much for joining us. I know your time is limited, but you've done so much work, and you were quoted by the LA Times in the piece that we've been talking about this hour, that I so appreciate you being with us today.
Oh, happy to be here.
I know there's a lot to talk about, but I'd like to start with some of the studies that you've been doing examining diversity in the entertainment industry. And you told the LA Times that 1999 was a real turning point in the discourse about diversity in Hollywood. Why was that? What have you seen in your studies, both in that time and now looking at 2020?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Right before this blockbuster story came out in the LA Times, which basically signaled of all the new shows that were being introduced that season, not one of them had a lead of color. And it was kind of a startling statistic when the story came out, and it created this maelstrom of conversation about what's wrong with Hollywood, why, you know, in a country like ours, Hollywood can't be more reflective of our diversity. And as it turns out, I had been working with the Screen Actors Guild for a few months at that point to produce one of their first studies on African Americans in television. It was called the African American Television Report. And when that story hit, it gave us a tremendous amount of momentum. We got the funding to do the study, and we were able to expose some of the ways in which Hollywood was simply not reflecting the culture that we all embrace. Over the years, a lot has changed. I mean, I've been working on this issue since that 1999-2000 moment that led to a consortium of advocacy groups like the NAACP, the National Hispanic Media Coalition, and a few other groups representing Asian Americans and Native Americans who threatened boycotts against the networks. The networks quickly responded by creating these vice presidents for diversity, those positions that, I mean, it was somewhat debatable as to how effective they were in the early days. A lot of people complained it was just window dressing and more symbolic gesture as opposed to real change. But since that period, about 20 years ago, America has shifted dramatically. Demographically, we're a lot more diverse than we were then. About 40% of the population, actually a little bit more than 40% of the population in the U.S. is people of color now. And our studies show that diversity sells. And in fact, people of color are driving ratings in TV and box office and film. So the networks have had to retool and address that reality. And in fact, we've been able to track over the 7 years we've been doing the annual Hollywood Diversity Report at UCLA, a huge shift in the number of leads of color, a somewhat less but notable increase in creators of color. Unfortunately, we haven't seen the same progress, you know, in the executive suites where, you know, we feel that a lot of the change needs to happen. And we really do need to have more people of color and women making greenlighting decisions.
Do you have the numbers available? I was looking at your report from 2018 and 2019, but that was the Academy Award report, the look at film, the top grossing films in those years.
So we released a report back in February of 2020 that looked exclusively at film. We decided this year to break the reports into two because we have so much data, looking at film separately. The plan was to release a TV version of that during upfronts. And, of course, upfronts were canceled because of COVID. So now we're hoping to release the TV portion right before Emmys in September. In any event, I can tell you, I can share data with you from the last report we did, which looked at the 2016-17 season. So we're a few years behind. It's a long story. It's based on the way we collect data. But this new report will bring us up to the, I believe, the 18-19 season. I think that's right. In any event, one of the most notable statistics is if you look at leads by race, leads of color increased from 5.1% of all leads in 2011-12 in broadcast to 21.5% in 2016-17. That's, you know, a quadrupling of the leads of color. That's quite notable. And again, we argue that that was largely due to changing demographics and also to changing technology. Streaming has become a phenomenon in TV, and the business model for the streamers like, you know, Hulu, Netflix, Amazon, et cetera, is different than, you know, traditional broadcast and cable in the sense that they're selling subscriptions to folks around the globe, and it's in their interest to have a broad portfolio of products because, you know, you pay one price and you get everything. And so they need to have a little bit of something for everyone. And that's created opportunities for creators of color and women creators that never would have gotten a real shot in broadcast or cable, and that's why we're seeing increases in those numbers. We see similar increases among digital leads. When we first started looking at the digital space in 2013-14 or so, Netflix only had a handful of titles. Now Netflix has more than any other platform, digital, broadcast, or cable. 9.1% of the leads in the digital space in 2013-14 were people of color. More than doubled to 21.3% by 2016-17. And my guess is that that trend has continued. I mean, we'll know for sure when our report comes out in the fall, but I think we're going to see a further increase in those numbers. So, yeah, there's been a real change, a lot of progress, certainly in front of the camera, but there's a lot of work that needs to be done behind the camera.
And what will make that happen? Our other guests, Calvin Brown Jr., Tina Chapman, Chris Thompson, they've all been talking about the need for more executives who are people of color making decisions, greenlighting projects. We can have these conversations, but what will it take to see tangible change, Dr. Hunt?
Well, we've been arguing that it's going to have to happen. I mean, if the industry wants to remain viable, we're a nation that's becoming about 0.5% more diverse each year, to the point where we're going to be majority-minority in a couple of decades. And Hollywood cannot continue to do business the way it's been doing it because, you know, all of our data show that people of color and women want to see representations on screen of their experiences. They want characters they can identify with. They want narratives they can identify with. And not that people who aren't people of color can't tell those stories. It's just that the way they're told is different when you have people in the room who've had certain types of life experiences, and it comes across as more authentic, more real. It resonates more closely with people's experiences, and it becomes more popular. So, you know, I did a study for Color of Change a couple of years ago called Race in the Writer's Room, and again, we found that writer's rooms are notoriously white in a nation that's becoming much more diverse. In fact, you know, out of 3,817 writers we examined in that study, and this was from 2015, so again, the data is a little old, but 65.4% of the writers' rooms had no black writers. And, you know, looking at people of color more generally, 86.3% of the writers in the writers' rooms we looked at were white, and, you know, most of the non-white writers were black, but again, you know, woefully underrepresented for all groups. And it just speaks to some of the structural issues we have here because you have showrunners basically hiring people with whom they feel comfortable that they've worked with before. And if you're already starting with a Hollywood that's white male dominated, well, that kind of leaves people of color and women largely out of the picture. So, you know, I think there have been some increases on that front since this study was done. And this is data from the Writers Guild. I've done work for them as well. But again, I know we still have a long way to go.
Speaking of that, I'm just thinking back to my experience. I went to the Newhouse School at Syracuse University to write television shows. I ended up in a very different place, but thinking back on my experience and who I was in class with and the types of professors that I had, it was a very, you know, the majority of people I was with were white people. And Dr. Hunt and Kelvin, I'll ask you both, what can we be doing either in high schools and colleges and training programs, apprenticeships, what can we be doing other than the programs that you're seeing now to increase diversity? What do you think would really make systemic change in bringing more aspiring writers to the industry that are people of color?
Well, maybe I'll take the first stab at this. So we released a study last year called By All Means Necessary, Essential Practices for Transforming Hollywood Diversity and Inclusion. And what we did basically was we put together a panel of experts, academics as well as people working in the industry, to identify programs that we felt had moved the needle on diversity, programs that worked for whatever reason. Then we identified people who were associated with those programs to do in-depth interviews with them to try to figure out what is it about your program that worked. And the goal was to come up with a list of best practices that the industry could embrace in order to move the needle in a major way, as opposed to just tinkering around the edges, which unfortunately is what we've seen all too often in Hollywood. And so MEANS is actually an acronym, By All Means Necessary, and MEANS, basically the M stands for Modernize Your Worldview, the E stands for Expand the Net, the A stands for Amplify Women, particularly women of color, the N stands for Normalize Compensation, and the S stands for structure incentives. And what we mean here is that those who are in control of these organizations need to get into the 21st century and realize that this is not your father's America. We are a country that's becoming majority-minority, and right now people of color are driving TV consumption and box office. What that means is that from top to bottom, your organization has to reflect that reality. Your staff should look like that. The people making decisions about what gets produced should look like that. The people writing and pitching ideas should look like that, et cetera. The E, expand the net, means that you have to get out of your comfort zone. You can't keep hiring people that you worked with before. You have to hire people who can produce the type of content that diverse audiences are demanding today. The A means that, you know, amplify women. When women are in charge, all the data show that the cast and crew is more diverse. Take Ava DuVernay, for example. She insists that, you know, when she's producing a show like Queen Sugar or doing a movie, that her cast and crew, not only above-the-line talent but below-the-line talent, is diverse. Normalized compensation. You know, people of color often come from backgrounds and or families that don't have some of the privileges that those who have traditionally dominated Hollywood do. And what that means is it's hard for them to start in the mailroom and work their way up, or to work in an unpaid internship, which is what Hollywood has often forced people to do to have a shot at getting a foothold, almost as if, you know, you're privileged or it's an honor for you to work in this industry, so you have to start at the very bottom. And that's created all kinds of inequities where you have, you know, white aspiring talent in Hollywood who are subsidized by their families, who can pay their rent while they're working in the mailroom, that type of thing. So there are all kinds of disincentives in place that make it hard to grow the pipeline of diverse talent going into the industry. And the last point, structure incentives, people don't give up power voluntarily. They have to be incentivized, or they have to be sanctioned when they don't share, when they don't manage diverse units and so forth. So we've argued that performance evaluations should and pay and bonuses should be tied to how diversified your organization is within studios, networks, etc. You know, when tax incentives are given by municipalities to incentivize different productions to locate there, they should insist that basic threshold standards are met in terms of how diverse those productions are. So there are lots of things we can do, and our argument is that none of these are silver bullets. One of them alone won't solve the problem, but if you really want structural change, you have to commit to all five of these essential best practices at the same time.
Dr. Hunt, I am so grateful for the work that you do and the time that you've taken to join us on the program today. I know your schedule is busy, and I promised I wouldn't keep you long. So thank you so much for everything that you've shared with us. Again, Dr. Darnell Hunt, Dean of Social Sciences and Professor of Sociology and African American Studies at UCLA. Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to talk with you.
Great talking to you, too.
Thank you. Calvin, I'd like to bring you into what Dr. Hunt just mentioned. Do you agree with the approach that he recommended for the industry?
I agree with a lot of it. The one thing I always tell people who want to be television writers or television producers like myself is that everyone's journey is different. There's no set formula on how to do this, because if it was, everybody would be doing it. Everybody's background is different, and what gets you from whatever city you live in and say Florida to ultimately get you to working on a show in Los Angeles, the journey you took is going to be different from the journey that I took going from North Carolina to get to Los Angeles. And that's one thing that is another hard thing. Like you say, the wherewithal, having your family be there for you and support you, because L.A. is a very expensive place to live, especially if you're going to go for this. But I will say this much now, as far as writers and producers are concerned, things have changed a lot since I started in 1989. There were only like a handful of internships back then, and I actually lucked up into mine. But now almost every studio has some kind of internship. They have some kind of way to bring people of color on board. And the thing is, you just have to take the time to look for them. They have internships literally every production studio, every network, every streaming service. Because right now, content is king, and it's like this is one of the best times to be a person of color trying to work in this industry, because there's now more than one place to go. I mean, when I started, there were only four networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, and Fox. Now, you know, it's still about that as far as networks, TV, throw in the CW, but now with all these other streaming services, there are hundreds of places where you can hopefully sell something and, you know, do good work. So that's one thing I tell people now, just look for any and every internship you can. And don't be afraid to apply for one that says, you know, we're looking for, you know, only Asian people, only black people, only Latinos, or only, you know, whatever. Sometimes your best bet is to say, you know what, read what I have on this paper. Maybe you might say, okay, we'll give you a chance to work with this group too. So there are ways now to get into the business, and the best thing about these internships now is like you get paid. And normally if you make it through the internship, they'll staff you on a show, and then you'll have a good year or two to prove yourself. So things have changed a lot, and I know you going to the Newhouse School, you worked with one of my mentors, Dr. Richard Dubin, who's like one of the absolute best people that I've ever worked with, and who, you know, still one of my mentors to this day. I still talk to him often. And Dubin has always been, you know, pro-black. Even though he's not black, he's black in his soul. But the thing is, he is, like, always been ahead of the curve trying to, like, bring people of color on board, because he understood it then. So now there's a whole lot more Richard Dubins now than there were when he started to do it. So it's important to have people that care about that, you know, people who want to make that difference. And I think right now is the time, because of what's going on. I think people want to try to make a difference right now. They don't want to be on the wrong side of history anymore.
Listeners, you're hearing from Calvin Brown Jr., a television producer and writer, Tina Chapman, the director of diversity theater at RIT, Chris Thompson, a local engineer, writer, comedian, and activist. I see your questions and comments starting to come in. I want to make sure we have some time to get to some of them. If you'd like to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK. That's 844-295-8255. Or if you're in Rochester, 263-WXXI, 263-9994. You can also email the program at connections@WXXI.org. Or you can find me on Twitter at MMacMedia. Tina, I'm going to direct this next question to both you and Chris, and it's from a listener named Charles. It's about casting, and he says, it seems like a lot of this discussion, in these types of discussions, only black people should be cast in black roles. women and female roles, gay people and gay roles, and et cetera. I'm curious as to how far your panel thinks we should be following this logic. And then he says, should the five veterans currently working in Hollywood have to act in all war films? Are we going to allow Nazis in Hollywood to portray members of the National Socialist Party? Should people with superpowers be the only actors and actresses allowed to play superheroes? It just feels like people who take this attitude never consider the second and third order effects. That's from Charles. What do you think, Tina?
Oh, I think that's a great question, and I'm glad Charles sent that in. When I was in film school, and I remember my first script writing class, I noticed that as we were reading scripts, oftentimes it would not identify the person's ethnicity, you know, race or ethnicity, unless the person was not white. So you may read about a particular character, and then when it gets to a character who's white, not white, they would also mention that person's race, African-American, or if they were Latina or Asian. And I got to thinking, well, why is it then, even on the writer's side, they assume everyone is white unless otherwise identified? So when I was in script writing class, I would do just the opposite. I would only identify the character if the character had to be white. Now, again, I did that mainly because I was pushing back on that type of behavior. But it did cause me later on to just think about, you know, unless the character needs to be a particular race, why even identify it in a script? Because a casting director is going to take that script, and if it says the person is Caucasian, for example, then that's who they're going to look to cast it, you know, with that role. But as a writer, if there is no necessity for having a particular ethnicity associated with the character, you can leave it open. You don't have to identify that. And then the casting agency, you know, can be more open in terms of how they're going to cast. Now, with that being said, even if you are a director and you have a script that may have been identified by the writer as having a particular ethnicity, it's up to you to decide then if you've got leeway to cast it in that way or not. But at the same time, we are talking about people, unless it's a biopic or something, you know, that is nonfiction, typically we're talking about a character that's made up. So you're able to use your creative eye or obviously the director's interpretation on who you think is best to portray that role. So I think Charles's question is right on, because people are actors, and if they are doing their jobs to the best of their abilities, they are going to embody this particular character based on what needs to come forward for that person's personality, the character's personality, the character's persona, obviously going after their goals and their motivation, and that is the job of the actor. So I think it's a good question, and I think more casting directors and directors need to have more of an open eye when you're interpreting those scripts.
Chris, what do you think? And I know you're approaching this question both as a writer and as a performer. Where do you fall?
I really think that I think it's important to like identify like who is the character that they're portraying. Usually if it's an historical character, if I see someone who was a real person who was black who's being played by a white person, I'm going to be a little bit more upset than if it's a fictional character. So, like, perfect example was Angelina Jolie played Marlene Pearl one time, Daniel Pearl's wife, in, like, this historical drama. That Marlene Pearl is black. Angelina Jolie is very white. So in cases like that, yes, the person should be, you know, whoever. It should be a woman. It should be someone who's transgender. It should be somebody who is a person of color, if that's a historical person. When it gets to other aspects, like fictional things, like fantasy films or something like that, usually I just throw a side eye if they cast, like, say, Scarlett Johansson as an Asian woman. You know, it's just a little bit ridiculous, and it's just kind of tropey of Hollywood to do that. That's why we push so much for diversity in Hollywood, because even when we had a chance to be portrayed, you know, that chance was taken away by a white actor. So, no, we don't need to go out and find the Nazi to play a Nazi. We can just mock Nazis. That's fine. And we don't need to find somebody who has superpowers to play somebody with superpowers, because superpowers are science fiction. However, we can definitely find plenty of black superpower things. We can start like producing Afrofuturism. Like there's Octavia Butler has an entire canon that can be turned into a movie, you know? And I think that's more important. And like whoever the actor is, I hope that they portray, you know, they're true to the character. But yeah, like I said, for the most part, when it comes to like actual real characters, if the historical person was a person of color or trans or disabled or something like that, get an actor who can do, who is that, who can act.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it'll be fine.
Well, we're down to our last minute or so, and I want to send one more question to each of our guests, maybe 30 seconds each. I'd like to hear what each of you are loving on television right now. Our listeners, maybe they're looking for a new show. Which shows are exciting to you? What's doing a good job of empowering people of color in the industry, Chris?
I refuse to shut up about Old Guard. It's a movie. It's not necessarily... it's kind of diverse. It's about an immortal woman. She finds out she's immortal by being killed in Afghanistan. She's a black woman. And Charlize Theron is kind of her old grizzly veteran immortal person. And, like, it's just this cadre of, like, warriors. But I think they really flipped a couple of things because usually Charlize Theron's kind of playing the magical Negro, except she's definitely not a Negro or magical. Well, she is magical. But, like, it kind of flips the roles, and I like that.
All right. Thanks, Chris Thompson. Tina Chapman, what's exciting for you on TV right now? What do you love?
Actually, I watch a lot of PBS. So I like, you know, like they did Les Miserables because they had a beautiful, diverse cast, and it was excellently done. And also a documentary called Advocate, which I talked about defending Palestinian youth in the Israeli courts. So I really like those types of shows.
Thank you. And Calvin Brown Jr., 10 seconds.
All I'm watching pretty much right now, to be honest, is MSNBC, CNN, seeing what's going on with this crazy world. But my wife watches a lot of TV, so I'll say watch The Chi and Greenleaf.
All right. Thank you very much. And also watch The Proud Family, Louder and Prouder. My thanks to
Absolutely.
Calvin Brown Jr., Tina Chapman, Chris Thompson. Thanks to Rob Braden, our engineer. I'm Megan Mack. We'll talk to you tomorrow on Member Supported Public Radio.